Today on Against the Grain, 145 years ago, the lower classes of the city of Paris rose up and established a worker-run government. They flew the red flag, championed the rights of women, and separated church and state. The Paris Commune had little time to put into place many of the Communards' ideals before it was violently crushed by the French state. The bloody repression was meted out on a massive scale and, historian John Merriman argues, foreshadowed the state violence that was to mark the 20th and 21st centuries. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In the spring of 1871, for a fleeting period of time, the workers of Paris rose up and launched a remarkable experiment in self-rule. It inspired radical movements, including those of May 1968 in France, and remains an inspiration for many who believe another way of organizing the world is possible. But the experience of the Commune left a mark in a different, much bleaker way, my guest argues, prefiguring in its repression the intense state violence that characterized the 20th century. Historian John Merriman argues that in the nearly century and a half since the Commune, various myths have sprung up, foremost being that the Communards burned much of Paris and provoked the violence against them. In his book Massacre, The Life and Death of the Paris Commune, published by Basic Books, he documents the vastly disproportionate violence of the French state in stamping out the Commune. John, I wonder if we could start by talking about the context in which the uprising that led to the Paris Commune took place. Who ruled France? What kind of rule was it? And what impact did the French defeat in the Franco-Prussian War, which had started the previous year, have on French society?
Well, France was ruled by an empire, the second empire of Napoleon III, and they get swept away in the war against Prussia and some of its German allies, and they're replaced with a very conservative provisional government. And when the provisional government wants to take the cannons back of the Parisian National Guard, that begins what's known as the Paris Commune, which began in Montmartre on March 18, 1871. And so the provisional government was in Versailles, run by a guy called Adolphe Thiers, and its assembly was packed with monarchists, and many Parisians had wanted to continue the fighting against Paris during the siege. And the Commune begins when Thiers sends the French regular army up to Montmartre to try to take the cannons back.
So what was life like for most Parisians, and obviously quite a divided society, in 1871 when the Paris Commune is established?
Well, I mean, they'd just gone through the siege, and the siege had lasted from early September until late January, and it was a time of coffins taking elderly people to their final destination and young children and babies who were most apt to not survive malnutrition. It was a time of not much to eat and of diminishing hope in a very cold winter in which even the Seine froze. So these were tough times. And lots of it was particularly difficult in the more proletarian neighborhoods. They changed their own small the district numbers in 1860 when the inner suburbs were annexed to Paris for tax reasons and policing reasons. And so basically the northeastern quadrant was people we would call People's Paris. It included lots of people kind of expelled by high costs from Paris during the rebuilding of Paris, the plowing through of boulevards in the 1850s and 60s, and newly arrived workers from the countryside. And that would be the basis of the support for the Paris Commune. It would be now what are known as the 12th and the 13th on the other side of the river, above all, the 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th arrondissements, or districts, People's Paris. So it was neighborhood action.
So what was the political culture amongst those sort of people in that part of Paris before the Commune was established? Because presumably nothing, comes out of the blue.
Yeah, well, these were people who were Republicans during the Empire and or socialists during the Empire, and they had been mobilized by a law that the Empire had promulgated in 1868 that allowed public meetings. So their sort of apprenticeship of the Republic was learning and debating about the kind of political world and social world that they imagined, in which they would have rights as citizens, and many women would have rights as women and as female citizens in some future regime. So it was a place associated with contentious politics and with support for basically a radical republic, a radical socialist republic for many, in which Paris would have the right to have its own municipal government.
How did these people seize power? You gave us a kind of quick sketch of the events that led up to the Paris Commune, but how, in fact, did these workers take control of the capital city of France?
Yeah, well, it started with women, because women in Montmartre were going to the market hoping against hope to find something they could afford to buy. And they see these French troops wearing their bright red pants. That would stop in 1914, because the Germans could pick them out through the fog. But they wore bright red pants, and they were up there with an inadequate number of horses to take back the cannons of the National Guard. So they went home and woke up the menfolk, and with children helping too, basically stop the descent of the cannons down to, for the Versailles government, would be a safer location. And so the Commune began in Montmartre, you know, above Paris in the 18th arrondissement, and spread to the rest of the proletarian neighborhoods. Thiers takes his army outside of Paris, and a second and more horrible siege began for the Parisians. So that's how it happened.
How did the communards establish power during the fleeting period of time where they actually had it, a mere 10 or so weeks? How did they self-organize? It was, the Paris Commune has come down to us as this sort of remarkable experiment in worker self-organization and an attempt to establish a more egalitarian society. So what did it actually look like?
Okay, well, there's, you know, what they call during the Russian Revolution, dual sovereignty sort of existed. The people of Paris, the men of Paris, only could vote. The role of women was terribly important in the Commune. They vote for an organization called La Commune, the Commune, which would be a political organization of leaders who would meet in the town hall. But the other aspect of this dual sovereignty was the National Guard. And the National Guard units were based in working-class neighborhoods in the above-mentioned arrondissement, like Belleville and Ménilmontant and Montmartre and places like that. And so there's sort of a dual organization, and it's amazing how much they succeeded in doing, because the cannons are getting closer. There are more people, ironically, in the western districts getting killed by cannon fire from Versailles, and they keep on meeting and keep on hoping until the bitter end. And the bitter end was Bloody Week, and that lasts from May 21st, Sunday, until May 28th, Sunday. And at that point, it's during Bloody Week when somewhere between 10 and 15,000 ordinary Parisians are executed.
And that, of course, is the massacre of the title of your book.
And the reason that I called it that is because for me, this period, and why one of the reasons I started to work on it, is that the demons of the 20th century and of our own century could be seen in the repression of the Paris Commune, that you could be killed for just being, you know, who you were. And it's like you could be killed for being Armenian in 1895 or 1915 on a much greater level. You could be killed for being a communist, or even much, much greater level for being Jewish during the time of World War II, or without trying to, you know, make a political to an easy kind of political comparison to make. You could be killed by simply being an Afro-American in Ferguson or in one of these other places. Hands up, don't shoot. So I guess I also am thinking about that as well, and about real terror attacks and state repression, both the other sides of the same coin in various places in the world today.
And we'll talk more about that as the program continues. I should say that I'm speaking to historian John Merriman about his book, Massacre, The Life and Death of the Paris Commune. That's published by Basic Books. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. As you say, much of your book is really about bringing back to our memories the scale of the repression of the commune. But so many listeners actually would not know about the commune itself, the kind of radical egalitarian impulse of the commune. So let's just stay with that for a bit more. I'd like to ask you about it. You mentioned there was a kind of dual sovereignty going on in the commune. There was the National Guard, which was the way that the commune defended itself. And then there were the organs of kind of workers' power. Can you tell us a bit more about how this entity ran itself, who participated in, if people wanted to participate, what did it look like? Because in so many ways, it seems like a vision that seems very far off.
Well, it was a mix of people. I mean, many of them were people who had no political experience in the past, but it included some people that are well known to American lovers of great painting. I mean, Gustave Courbet started the Federation of Artists to try to take advantage of the new freedom, and he was elected mayor of the 6th arrondissement, which is a pretty fancy arrondissement in Paris, around Odeon and the Gardens of Luxembourg, and he was an activist in there. But so were lots of very ordinary people who just happened to be elected thanks to neighborhood coalitions, and they're fighting and debating over what kinds of measures, military measures to encourage and what kind of social measures to take. And towards the end of the commune, the kind of Jacobin factor with a tradition in the French Revolution decide almost inevitably to declare a Committee of Public Safety, which had existed in 1793 and 94 when another republic was under siege. So, I mean, they kept on debating, and they kept on talking, and that was extremely important. And you had members showing up at the club movements, and the clubs met in churches. They met in churches not because they were religious, but in any city or in any village, a church was the largest place that people could be gathered. So if you think of a church like Saint-Eustache, which is beautiful, which is an old Gothic church in the center of Paris near where they all used to stand, and you have a club there, and you would have women standing up in the pulpit and calling for the right of women to have a divorce or the women to have nurseries for working women and that kind of thing. So it was a time of, you know, frenetic thinking and imagination about what a future could look, even as the guns drew closer. And that's what makes it very interesting. You know, the whole thing was just, it's thrilling and saddening to research and to write about and to see how it ends. But it was a time of great hope and of great illusion, to be sure. But it's still the commune. I just noticed the other day, and I actually live in France, but I'm talking from New Haven, Connecticut. But the other day, the French Chamber of Deputies issued an official apology to all the people who had been slaughtered by the forces of Versailles. So that's kind of an amazing thing. And when, you know, American tourists who know about the commune go to France, they go up to the Père Lachaise Cemetery, where the last fighting took place. And they go to a place called the Wall of the Fédérés, of the people who wanted Paris to have its own government. And that's where lots of people were simply shot in front of this big ditch, which makes one think of Poland in 1939, 1940, 1941 as well, but admittedly on a much smaller scale. And that became kind of the site of memory for the Paris Commune and all these hopes that were debated in town hall and eventually were fought for in the narrow streets of People's Paris.
Well, and those ideas were varied, although it was a radical experiment in running a city in a very different way. It seems like people were motivated by different ideas and different threads came through. You had mentioned the central role of women in the commune. Can you talk about the strong feminist thrust that was present in the Paris Commune?
Yeah, there were some major figures of whom I discuss, in my book. One, the most obvious, who's about whom lots has been written, is Louise Michel. And Louise Michel was a poor woman from the Haute-Saône, which is in the Not from the old town, from the old mound in the east of France. And she became a school teacher and always wore black and was kind of dissed as the Red Virgin because of her politics. But she was somebody who fought for the rights of women, and she spoke in clubs before men, you know, eating sausages and drinking wine, and fought in the commune literally herself. And she was finally exiled because they couldn't execute her. They sent her to New Caledonia, and she became an anarchist because she'd seen state terror up close. And she got it right. She, in this case, I'm not an anarchist, but I'm appalled by state terror. And so she ends up leading the first marches on May Day in Paris, the first May Day marches in the early 1890s. So she was one, and I follow somebody else called Nathalie Lemel, who was a wife of a drunken Breton, somebody from Brittany, and she'd started out working, managing a consumers cooperative in Montmartre, and she ends up being, somebody who fought in the Paris Commune. There was a woman called Elizabeth Dmitriev, who's a Russian noble. She comes to Paris and takes an active role in the Commune, and she fights until the bitter end. So, not as many women are killed or as executed as men, but there was a kind of a bestialization or dehumanization of women participants by the Versailles victors, which allowed their mistreatment because they're seen as not human. And much attention to how they dressed and how they looked. That's the Red Virgin and all this business. Louise Michel always dressed in black. So women play a role in Paris, but they had in 1848 in that revolution, and they had in the French Revolution as well. But it's one of the fascinating things well worth following.
How did that kind of the contributions of those women and the concerns of working class women following the siege that had gone on during the Franco-Prussian War and then the hardships of life in Paris, how did those concerns become reflected in the laws and ideas governing the commune itself during its time?
Sure. Just take one example. One thing that happens early in April is they separate the church and state, and that finally happens in France in 1905. But they do it during the commune because one of the opposition, the things that lots of women oppose, is the increasing role of the clergy, of nuns in particular, from the congregations in being overwhelmingly responsible for the teaching of girls fortunate enough to be able to go to school. And so there is a wave of anti-clericalism. Not all priests, not all nuns were horrendous reactionaries, but that explains to an extent why, you know, women wanted the right to divorce and wanted the right to have lay teachers in their schools. And that helps explain why it was that, you know, the commune did take some hostages when the Versailles government are shooting captured soldiers outside of Paris. They take a few hostages, including the Archbishop of Paris, who's one of the persons just in my book, and I followed him around too. And, you know, I have a lot of respect for the Archbishop Georges Darbois of Paris, who finally is executed on Wednesday, May 24th. But, you know, some 65 priests and nuns and a few other random lay people are killed as hostages. That, I mean, that's a terrible thing, but that's a lot less than 15,000, which is the body count, the minimum body count, despite some debates now, of people who were executed simply for being whom they were, living and speaking with a proletarian accent in the suburbs of Paris or in the 20s arrondissement, or because they had the rough hands of work, or because they were Polish or Russians, because there were Poles and Russians who fought. There were Americans also who fought for the Paris Commune and a few random British subjects as well. So, yes, anti-clericalism, particularly among women, and it comes out in the discussions and the lectures, the talks going on in these clubs, was an important theme.
And how did socialist ideals get reflected in the Paris Commune and the laws passed and the way people organized themselves?
There wasn't much time. I mean, all the communards were not socialists. There were some anarchists, so that number has been increased. Some were just moderate Republicans that wanted Paris to have a mayor. Because of the importance of Paris, Paris didn't have a mayor until 1977. Until the corrupted Jacques Chirac became mayor. That was a political comment there, but anyway, became mayor of Paris because the mayor would have been seen as a potential rival to the president of France. There were also socialists. There were democratic socialists. There were radical Republicans. It's not just socialists. And they didn't have much time. You know, they passed a couple pieces of legislation that are always quoted in textbooks, including mine. You know, they banned night baking because it seemed that only the bourgeois needed their croissant hotly fresh in the morning, and going to work at 2 in the morning is not very easy. Well, that's right, you know, can be contradicted. You know, and they set up a number of these nurseries for working women, and they, again, an important socialist demand, they separated church and state. But they didn't have much time to do things. You know, the guns are getting closer. The commune only lasts from basically March 18th, and then they have to set up this commune until... well, the invasion really begins on Sunday, May 21st. So it's amazing how much they did accomplish.
Bearing in mind what you just said about the short amount of time the commune was even in power, what was its relationship to France outside of Paris?
Well, I mean, the illusion and the hope was that somehow Lyon and Marseille would come rushing to save Paris, or Toulouse or Limoges. And there were communes proclaimed in other cities in Paris. And they varied in terms of what they wanted to accomplish. The most famous ones are the ones I just gave you, Limoges, Lyon, Marseille, but also Saint-Étienne, which is a big working-class place, and Le Creusot also, and Narbonne, as they say down there, Narbonne, which was militant at every kind of wave of social and political contention. But, you know, the communards had no hope of defeating a professionally trained army. And Bismarck allows French POWs out so they could fight for Thiers. And by the time May 21st rolls around, they had 130,000 trained soldiers who had been trained on the fact that the communards were a bunch of criminals who were drinking the wines of the rich and deserved any fate that happened to them. The communards may have had at the beginning in numbers 220,000 people, but in fact only 20,000 and maybe as few as 10,000 actually fought. So it was a one-sided battle if there ever was one there. And it's amazing how far they went. And they knew they weren't going to win. And they knew they were going to die. There are cases of people just getting up on the barricade and saying, okay, just wait for that hit that's going to kill me. And, you know, it really is kind of amazing. The account that I tried to relate of Bloody Week, you know, it's got a lot of kind of magic moments, not from the writing, but from the experience of ordinary men and women in the Paris Commune, and these neighborhoods, and these barricades, and these fires, and this many ways to die. It's the most important event in the 19th century, in my humble opinion.
Well, let's talk about Bloody Week and the fury that was unleashed by those in power and the wealthy to take Paris back. You mentioned that the French government under the leadership of Thiers had gone to Versailles and then mustered forces that then surrounded the city. Were there also wealthy people still inside Paris during that time in large numbers? Had most of them fled? Or?
Well, lots of them had fled toward champagne bottles in Versailles or to country houses, but there were still people, and I follow the lives of some of those. I don't just follow communards in the book. I followed Archbishop Darbois. I follow some wealthy families that were mostly concerned with hanging onto their property and this sort of thing. But lots of wealthy people were able to get out, the western districts or prosperous western districts of Paris had largely been emptied out. And of course, young men, whether they were poor or prosperous, were obliged legally to participate in the National Guard. And that was another one of the reasons that these people left. Of course, the ones who stayed bitterly hated the commune, though not all wealthy people hated the commune. I mean, it's not just a black or white situation. But I follow these people along, including a pretty interesting, fairly dim-witted family who managed to escape thanks to the help of ordinary working people by train from the Gare du Nord and make it to Saint-Denis, which was behind the German lines at that time.
The kind of violence that was unleashed against the communards and actually working-class Parisians more broadly was so intense. And I wanted to ask you about what drove that intense violence? Was it simply some notion that they had taken Paris away from us and we need to get it back? Or was there something that seemed almost more existential, because the thirst for vengeance seems very pronounced in the scale of the violence?
Yeah, sure. But, I mean, not all of the commanders of Paris, of the Versailles commanders, were, you know, were just there murdering people right and left. There was a, you know, kind of a Republican, moderate Republican who controlled part of Paris, and if you got arrested in his sector, you were okay. But there also were horrendous cases. There were, of a guy called Gallifet who had ordered the execution of men, all men with white hair, because they must have been alive during the Revolution of 1848. But remember, the soldiers who are fighting for the government of Versailles are not working class people. Many of them are peasants from Normandy, peasants from Brittany. They're conservative in a time when the claims of organized religion were diminishing on very many French people, depending on the region. Brittany and Normandy were still fairly practicing Catholic, and as these troops were being trained out at Versailles and near Versailles, they were forced to read newspapers like Le Gaulois and Figaro, which is still a right-wing newspaper, in which there was kind of a demonization of the communard as being less than human. That therefore, the bestialization, really, of women in particular, that's an interesting case. So they're not getting them down, though some women are shot, which would justify their kind of you know, up against the wall after a few questions. And so... you're able to follow this thanks to the archives. And in the story, in the book, I have many stories of just amazing escapes. I mean, people were lying in the Garden of Luxembourg not to wait for a movie ticket to be shot, and who managed to escape because, you know, the person guarding him was a medical student, and this guy had a Red Cross thing on his arm, and he said, but you know, 4-5-3-2 to be shot, and you can hear the machine guns, you can hear these people being just killed in huge numbers. Think of that next time you go to the killing fields of the Garden of Luxembourg. And 5 minutes later, with his savior, he's drinking wine in a bar across from the Garden of Luxembourg. You know, so it's fun to write that kind of tale. In fact, I found that bar, and of course I've done the same thing, because I never write about anything I haven't seen. But, I mean, serendipity, just, you know, blind luck. I mean, all the soldiers weren't, you know, mass murderers. But that's sort of one of the points I try to make, is this sort of dehumanization by those called, they used to call the honnêtes gens, or the men of property, of the lower classes. And the dehumanization, if you see elegant women going out to the prisons out near Versailles to inspect closely female prisoners, describing them as whinnying like horses or behaving like bears, or, you know, and the way they're dressed, there's obsession with the way they look. And this allows them to be seen as a cancer that needs to be cut out. And they're using the kind of biological language that would come back to haunt Europe at the end of the 19th century, and above all in the 1920s and 30s. Where if you dehumanize them, or if you attribute crimes to them they didn't commit, then therefore they can be shot or killed or whatever, or sent to New Caledonia. And so there's one of the myths that's important to relate is the myth of the female incendiaries, les pétroleuses, right, who were believed to be burning down the Bank of France and burning down the wine cellars of the wealthy. And this is a sheer illusion. But because there were so many fires in Paris, because of the shelling and because of the way that the Versailles troops were trying to attack barricades, and because of a few random and totally reprehensible attempts to burn down Notre Dame and the Louvre, there was a sense that the women were potentially incendiaries who are going to burn down the houses of the wealthy and responsible for all the fires in Paris. So there was a time of great drama in rhetoric, too, as well as on the streets of Paris.
Historian John Merriman is my guest. We'll return with him in a moment.
So you on your high horse on top of your hill, you with your White House and cops and God's will, out of the crowd in a cloudless blue sky, comes Louise Michelle, and there's fire in her eyes. under your nose at the foot of the hill. People ride round on the grand carousel. Children play free in Place Louise Michel. And I know where I'd rather be any day. Any day. So here's to the commune and Louise Michel. Here's to no gods and no masters. And if I had to choose between heaven and hell, I'd choose you and the streets of Montmartre any day. Any day.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today we're speaking about the Paris Commune, when in 1871 the residents of Paris overthrew their government in a 10-week-long experiment in establishing an egalitarian society before it was violently crushed. And I'm speaking with the author of Massacre, The Life and Death of the Paris Commune, that's published by Basic Books. John Merriman is professor of history at Yale University and author of many books, including The Dynamite Club. So you touched on it a bit earlier, but I wonder if you can give us a sense of the scale of the repression of the commune and remind us how disproportionate it was in terms of the violence that was meted out on the communard side versus that of the French state.
Well, there were 65 hostages, mostly priests, who were killed, some by crowds, some by execution squads at the prison of La Roquette. On the side, although historians may debate the actual numbers, and we don't have body counts, at least 12 and certainly 15, and according to the government, 17,000 Parisians died during the Paris Commune. Either they were summary executions, or they're killed in the fighting, or they're simply, they died because they existed. They died because of their language, their accent, because of rough hands, because of the neighborhood had been targeted as seen as like Belleville, being particularly associated with left-wing politics throughout the previous 75 years. It was the largest massacre in 19th century French history. My head is spinning now trying to come up. I guess we didn't find anything comparable until executions of the Armenians by the Turks in 1895 and again, much greater scale, 1915. But it was important for me in what it represented because it unleashed the demons of the 20th century. It anticipated, is a better term, the demons of the 20th century, when you could be killed for just being who you were. In the case of Parisians, for being poor from the wrong neighborhood, working in the wrong trade. The one guy was arrested by two soldiers, and they said, what do you do for a living? He said, well, I'm a mason. And then one of the soldiers said, sergeant said, well, so it's masons who are going to run France now, huh, up against the wall. And then the shots that followed took his life. So, it was something that we hadn't seen. There were, you know, massacres during the 30 Years' War in Central Europe, 1618, 1648. There were massacres on both sides during the Terror, during the French Revolution. There were the June Days massacres in Paris in 1848. But this was something different. This was a state terror. And if you're going to account for the importance of the 19th century, it's state making, the rise of centralized nationalist states, the unification of Italy and Germany and all that, and a centralized state in France, et cetera, or Russia, where the Tsar is unleashing the hundreds to execute Jews in the pogrom and in Odessa and other places. And the other is the victory of large-scale industrialization, large-scale capitalism. And state terror, I mean, the word terror actually comes from the French Revolution, the terror in trying to save the French Revolution, those who are fighting against it inside France and professional armies outside of France. And most of the victims of the terror were people in war zones. But state terror, the capacity of states to control, you know, public, the means of public violence is something you see no more dangerously than in the Paris Commune, which is why I wrote the book.
So you're making the argument that obviously the kind of violence and the way violence could be exercised had been transformed because of the emergence of centralized states. But would you not also see some parallels with the ferocity of violence in the past that was based around, for lack of a better term, class warfare? I mean, clearly, sure. In the case of the French Revolution, unlike the Paris Commune, you have...
Well, it's not class warfare, but it's complicated.
Right, yeah. but you have, you know, so on the one hand, you have a terror that comes
other,
from
the
revolution.
Other terror is real. I mean, the book I did before Massacre was Dynamite Club, which you kindly alluded to, where I'm trying to understand the hatred of an anarchist. Most anarchists were not violent. They were anything but violent, but they didn't believe in the centralized state, a guy called Émile Henry. And I tried to understand his terror, and I followed him around for his terrorism. And he to my mind, starts... organized terror when he throws a bomb into a cafe called the Café Terminus near the Gare Saint-Lazare in Paris in 1894. And I followed this dude around for 2 years. I mean, not literally. I wanted to understand his hatred. And terrorism is a real thing. I mean, we see it in Ohio State the other day. We see it in Nice. We see it in Charleston. We see it in lots of places. I live in Paris, my apartment. I live in the south of France, but we have an apartment near Charlie Hebdo and near where lots of people died on November 13th. Terrorism is real. But the subtext of Dynamite Club is the way in which states use the real threat of terrorism to obtain their political means. But that's a different book. But it's also, one of the reasons I wrote Massacre is because this dude, Émile Henry, who was a killer, he dies at age 21. If you're going to write a book about one, which one person features, it's good to pick somebody who died at 21 because it's a shorter book. But his father had been condemned to death during the Paris Commune. And his father became an anarchist because he saw state terror up close. So it's this kind of duet, if you will, between, it's not my line, I think my friend Marty Miller at Duke came up with this, I didn't even get the line right, but it's this sort of duet between state and state terror and terror that interests me.
What was the effect of the Paris Commune and then its repression on the rest of Europe? And I'm thinking of both for the rulers and the ruled.
Well, sure. There are some British journals that were very sympathetic to the Commune, but basically the British attitude was, well, there they go again, the French, and we hope France doesn't catch a cold and Europe sneezes. The French provisional government got the Belgians to expel Victor Hugo. Most of the public and state reaction to the Paris Commune was one of vigorous opposition to the Paris Commune. But of course, in terms of politics, and the Paris Commune became the worst nightmare of anarchists, and that's another reason why they wanted the state abolished. And think of the Haymarket massacre in the United States in Chicago, which is terribly important in the collective mentality of American left-wing politics.
Which is later that decade.
Yeah,
am
which
I
is later.
Right? Yeah.
And also, for the socialists, both revolutionary socialists and socialists who wanted to be elected into power in France, in Germany, in Spain, the Paris Commune came as an example of what a centralized state that doesn't have the interest in the people, of the people, might well do. So it becomes terribly contentious, and the Wall of the Fédérés, you weren't allowed to go up there and give speeches, and in Paris, some people would leave flowers and that kind of thing. But as I said, things shift, and over the long run, the Paris Commune has become part of the historical neighborhood, a narrative of modern French history. Even Nicolas Sarkozy had to make some sort of neutral comment about the Paris Commune, and the Chamber of Deputies just expressed their excuses, as I said earlier in this broadcast. Their apologies to the French state for having killed all these people. And my kids were in school a lot in France, and this was part of the history that they studied. So things have changed very much. There's a huge association of Friends of the Communard, and they meet every year. They're always publishing this and that, so now it's part of the national narrative. But it's important for understanding what's significant about the 19th century. And that's why I wrote the book. Yeah.
And then in terms of that, the sort of national narrative, after the commune was stamped out, it seems like the French state and its supporters very much wanted to shape the narrative of the commune. And one thing that comes to mind is tourists who go to Paris flock to the Basilica of the Sacré-Cœur on Montmartre without much, I think in probably most cases, a sense of its origins.
They ought to think about that before they go up to that damn place, yeah.
Yeah, so tell us about its origins.
Well, the origins of Montmartre is that before the conservative Catholic Church, the God must have been publishing France to have sinned by bringing the Franco-Prussian War, a horrible defeat, and the Paris Commune. And so on the very spot where they beat up and killed some communards, money was raised to create this Sacré-Cœur, which is, has some nice architectural features of it. It has southwestern French as in Perigueux and Saintes and places like that. It looks like cathedrals there influenced by Byzantine architecture, et cetera. But when you think what it represents this sort of slaughter of all these people. Though, in my time, I've gone up there and done radio shows up there or broadcasts because of because Sacré-Cœur was always a target for anarchists. Zola has a great novel called Paris. He published Paris. He published in 1898, and it's sort of strange because it involves a priest who's losing his religion, not the REM song, quite the same thing, but he's losing his organized religion, and he has a brother who's an anarchist living in Neuilly, of all places. And in the book, he describes the kind of dreams of anarchists, which were real, of trying to blow up Sacré-Cœur, because it represents the Catholic Church and its close traditional association, at least till 1905, with the French state. So it's one of those memory sites that I view with some trepidation. I'll take the Wall of Fédéré any day.
Historian John Merriman is my guest. We're discussing his book, Massacre, The Life and Death of the Paris Commune. That's published by Basic Books. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. How long did the period of repression last in Paris following the Paris Commune? You talked about Bloody Week, but obviously a violent event like this is not something that then just disappears. Half of Paris was burned down, tremendous violence meted out. How long did the period of martial law last, and how long was the pall of the repression of the Paris Commune over Paris?
Sure. Well, they were still executing people in June of 1871. They were executing people in November. Léo Ferré, who was an important political personage and not the most admirable person in the Paris Commune, was executed. The trial of Louis Michel went on. Basically, the repression lasts through what is called the Republic of the Moral Order that survives until 1877. It's very influenced by the Catholic Church, thus Sacré-Cœur, and it lasts until the president of France, a religious marshal called Mac Mahon, attempts really to use a legislative coup d'etat to bring the Republic in. There's repression during that period of all sorts of things. I'll give you just a kind of an interesting example Manet, the painter, the great painter Manet, he was not for the commune, but he was against the repression. He did a couple lithographs. One is very, very famous, called Guerre Civile, Civil War, in which you see a body right near a Madeleine. And you know it's Madeleine, and you know it's a National Guardsman by his uniform, and you see him waving a white handkerchief, and he's dead. He's not waving it anymore. Well, Madeleine was not a neutral site. It was where they executed, took out of the church and shot dead about 200 or 300 people there. And this lithograph of Manet was illegal in Paris till about 1875. And so were a lot of writings that seemed to want to exonerate the Paris Communards. They published all sorts of photographs, not of people. The Communards published photographs of people, of boys and girls and men standing in front of cannons, standing in front of barricades before it all just went south. And the Communards, the the Versailles government, what they did is they did a lot of photographs of buildings they claimed had been destroyed, in some cases, yes, by the Communards, in which there aren't people in front of them. They're trying to say, here's what the barbarians have done, and thus they deserve whatever happens. All sorts of people were sent to New Caledonia. A lot of them are forced to spend months living on rafts outside of La Rochelle and Rochefort in the west of France. The repression goes on. There are people who don't come back for decades. I cited Louise Michel earlier. That was a good choice because she ends up leading the march of strikers, of radicals, of socialists, in the call for greater greater rights for them. So, but they're not executing people in the 1880s. There's an amnesty in 1879, in 1880, and some of these folks are allowed to come back to France. I mean, the murdering days are all over.
How did the experience of the Commune affect the kind of radicalism, the radical ideas that were held by people in Paris and in France in the subsequent years? You mentioned Emile Henry and his father being a communard, and how he responded by becoming very, very critical of the state.
So very violent. He was a killer.
And obviously targeting the state. It sharpened a kind of anti-statist view. Obviously, the range of radical ideas would be wide, but I wonder, to what degree can you see currents of thought that were influenced by that, and also around the question of kind of spontaneous self-organization, uprising by workers, and any reflection on the power of the state to sort of repress these sorts of experiments.
Yeah, well, the anarchists began, attempted to organize, increase the number of their faithful by organizing the way the Commune had done, that is, by neighborhood. So that's important. But let me not leave anyone with the impression that the Commune was a radical experiment in creating this socialist state. I mean, the stuff that the Communards want are things that people in France or the United States, or maybe fewer now than a couple months ago, would have wanted to have. That is, school teachers with lay credentials and churches not calling the whole thing, of women having the rights to vote, right? Women having the rights to have their own economies. You know, in France, women didn't have the right to have their own checkbooks or to have a job without their husband's permission until 1964. The Commune was really not a radical experiment to the extent that it would be ordinary people ruling their own lives. That was what was radical about it, but not in what they wanted. They wanted a separation of church and state, and church and state have been separated in France since 1905. And one of the nice things, by the way, that occurred after these various attacks is that and the role of the church in World War One helped, not Vichy, they helped the church not at all, but World War One, the church was so important. You know, priests and nuns and rabbis and other people of the cloth is that after the recent attacks that we had in France when that priest was killed in Saint-Étienne-du-Rouvray near Rouen, one of my friends was right outside the church when this happened, that people the next Sunday, people who don't go to church, who never go near churches, went to church to try to say, we are here with you now. And gradually in French history, after about 1890, the church makes its peace with not everybody in the church, but makes its peace with the secular French state, and things get a lot better. A lot of the disharmony would end. Of course, Vichy changes that. Vichy France, that is during World War II, changes that to a great extent because of the very contradictory and often complex role of the Catholic Church during that period. But voila.
What do you think is the legacy of the Commune today? You were talking about the importance of the Commune as one of the first instances of this kind of intense state repression that would scar the 20th century. But in terms of the Commune itself, given what you've just said about, in fact, so many of the ideas or demands or policies, ideas, laws that came out of the Commune might strike us as broadly progressive and not all that radical.
Wanting to have a mayor.
Right. But
it's not totally radical.
But obviously, the idea of kind of self-organization does touch on something different. Do you think that the commune, that part of the legacy of the commune, lives on today or is lost in the midst of history? I mean, thinking about something like Occupy, would it be too much of a leap to leap from here to there?
No, I think that's a good thing. Ironically, you should ask that. My daughter explained to the French on France Culture, because she was involved in Occupy, what it all meant. I think that's a very good point that you just made there. I mean, in 1968, in what you could call the failed revolution of 1968, the images of the Paris Commune were terribly important. And what I'm about to say is not self-serving. I don't mean to say that at all. But if you look at the places that have already translated this book, there are places in which the role of ordinary people in cities like Paris have over, depending on you're talking about the Chinese Revolution, because the Chinese have translated it, whether you're talking about Brazil now, because the Brazilians are translated. We're talking about Spain because of the role of Barcelona vis-a-vis, the Franquise and all of that, or the Dutch, the role of Dutch cities in defeating the Spanish way back in the late 16th and early 17th century. Those are the places where the commune still continues to live on, which I think is important. And it does in France as well, because of the role, particular role of Paris and the particular politics of Paris, particularly in the ongoing struggles there and the impact of immigration and all of that. So I would say yes. I mean, being a sort of a communard myself, as you can probably tell, the commune does live on, and people seem to be still fascinated by it. It's incredible, and I remain among that number.
So I just wanted to return to the point that you made about state repression. You said that you think of the Paris Commune as being one of the signal events, or maybe the signal event, of the 19th century. But if that's the case, perhaps you could tell us why. Is it simply because it pointed the way to how things would be? It was the first in a whole series, or something that resonated beyond just being the first event?
Well, I mean, say two things. One, it anticipates, as I've said before, the demons of the 20th century, when you could be toast, could be killed just for being who you were. And so for me, that that's very important. And secondly, is that they are putting forward claims of the rights for ordinary people. And that is a theme that, despite the Europe of extremes and despite what happens in the 20th century with fascism being so widespread and Nazism and Stalin's gulag, that the drive, for example, of women for the same rights as men became terribly important, whether to have the right to vote in England, in Britain, which is granted only after World War I because of participation, and not in France until after World War II, that these are issues, these are important demands that can be seen in this sort of important magic moment, bloody however it ends, of the Paris Commune.
I've been speaking with the author of Massacre, The Life and Death of the Paris Commune, published by Basic Books. You can find a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. John Merriman is Charles Seymour Professor of History at Yale University and author of many books, including The Dynamite Club. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.